coercive control. Can you explain to us exactly how this is defined and how it differs from our current understanding under domestic violence legislation?
Yeah, existing domestic violence legislation tends to criminalise an individual act. And while coercive control can also criminalise an individual act, it really looks to a collection of several related acts or behaviours that form a pattern of behaviour. And those pattern of behaviours tend over usually a period of time, usually in a relationship, ongoing relationship, or perhaps old relationship, tend to form a pattern that isolates, controls, intimidates, subjects an individual to threats of violence or even behaviour that then could escalate into violence. And that's the real difference between a coercive control offence and what we might call a standalone assault, traditional criminal law assault, or a standalone offence that seeks to target intimidation or other acts of discrete control.
So on establishing an ongoing pattern of behaviour, as I say, this has kind of been criminalised already in the likes of over in the UK, and Tasmania's kind of followed suit on this one. Why the difficulty, I guess, in establishing this one in other places like other Australian states?
Yeah, the difficulty really is in terms of the individually identified behaviours which, taken collectively over time, shows that pattern, reveals that pattern of control. Depending on how the legislation is drafted in each of the jurisdictions that you've mentioned, they each have their own model and they each do it slightly differently with different conduct elements, although there's a great deal of similarity. There's also what we call fault elements, that is the state of mind, what we call the requisite state of mind of the accused person that needs to be coincidental with those behavioural elements. And there are slight variations across those jurisdictions. The real issue, the sticking point, if you will, the concern in the community is that if you look at the behaviours individually, they may not be a criminal act or a criminal offence. They may not be offensive at all. But then potentially when taken together, particularly when taken in hindsight perhaps, with rather than a subjective state of mind of the accused, what the actual accused was thinking, but rather what a reasonable person ought to have thought or would have thought in the circumstances, potentially older behaviours that at the time were innocent behaviours or intended by an accused person to be innocent now come to be criminalised as part of this pattern of behaviour. And when you look through the standard list, as I said, it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but there is a significant commonality between them. There's quite a few behaviours there that some people might look at and go, oh, well, you know, I may have participated in that with my partner. And individually, on its own, as a random act, it might not be anything, and certainly nothing that points to intimate partner violence or domestic violence or some type of ongoing controlling behaviour. What this offence is seeking to do, though, is pick up those people that do have that pattern and where perhaps there may be an escalation, and that escalation could point to violence. And, of course, you've already highlighted some of the devastating consequences of escalating controlling behaviours.
In some of these matters already, in terms of matters of domestic violence, obviously it is difficult to provide proof in some circumstances, given these are, you know, once upon a time regarded as a private matter, because obviously it happens in private, out of the view of other people's by and large. Does this help with that burden of proof? Do you think this establishment of a pattern, does that help with this burden of proof?
Well, in many ways, the establishing of the evidence is probably in the modern era, in the modern period, easier to do than it was in the past when it was private. And it was purely private and people saw it as something not to be discussed. Therefore, it was for the victim to put the case together and bring it to the police largely, or perhaps if the police were on the scene and intervening, for them to put some evidence forward. But now largely with mobile phone technology, smart technology, social media, where there is a pattern of intervention, of control, where the the liberty and freedom of the individual, the victim, is being increasingly restricted, where there is tracking or monitoring by the perpetrator of the individual, of the victim, through, say, social media or through various apps through which you can communicate, send messages over the phone, and in other ways potentially as well, traditionally through controlling money, through bank accounts, and other ways of perhaps stalking and intimidating a person that can then be recorded, perhaps again through smart technology, could be through CCTV footage or other technological means. It would now be, in the modern period, much more easier to evidence, if you bring those various disparate behaviours together, more easier to reach the burden to prove those behaviours exist, and that perhaps then they exist in a pattern to intimidate, control, or abuse an individual. So the advent of the modern era and smart technology is a blessing and a curse. It allows for, in many ways, the contact with the victim that allows for that coercive control. You get offenders saying, "Send me a photo of what you're wearing today," as a means of controlling that person. Well, all that's now possible through mobile phone technology. It wasn't in the past. So the means of access is provided. That's the curse. But in some respects, the ability to then put forward evidence of the control is there, because it's all recorded, usually all recorded through smart device.
Well, Soren, I do appreciate you unpacking this one for us a little bit. Obviously, one to keep our eyes on. Really do appreciate your time.
Welcome.